Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Saladin Ambar, who's the author, this time round, of Stars and Shadows, The Politics of Interracial Friendship from Jefferson to Obama. And this was published by Oxford University Press, I believe, in 2022. And like so much of Saladin's other works, it's incredibly well-written, compelling, and just a joy to read, and really fascinating. I've always been interested in the concept of friendship, particularly given how the ancients have posited that it's so important to the polity. And political friendship is what, you know, Aristotle and Socrates talk about. And you're talking about the role of friendship in our understanding of race in the United States and white supremacy, and how modeling interracial friendship may be important for us to understand where we are as a culture. But I'm going to ask Saladin first to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project as opposed to his other projects.
Well, Lily, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to see you and be with you on these podcasts over the years. So thank you again. I really appreciate it. And I do value your friendship. So thank you. I am a American political development person within political science. I focus on the presidency and governorships. But I also write a bit about race, probably more than a bit. And this project arose out of an article that I was working on that eventually was published with the Journal of Race and Ethnic Politics on W.E.B. Du Bois and his friendship and intellectual relationship with William James, his Harvard graduate professor. That article was in the works, and it was workshopped out at the University of Oregon, where my good friend and former dissertation advisor, Dan Titchener, suggested, along with others who attended that workshop, that article be turned into a book, that there were other great examples of intellectual relationships that had important democratic implications. And I thought about it and considered what that would look like historically. And so began the project of Stars and Shadows.
And Stars and Shadows, you start off talking about, you know, again, how we want to think about the role of democracy and human relations within it. And you are an expert on the founding period and what a lot of the framers had to say. And you note Madison's commitment to the fact that the expansive republic was going to help modulate problems. But how does friendship then fit into a republic of 330 million people that is across a vast expanse of land?
Well, you know, one of my great graduate professors, the late Wilson Carey McWilliams, who's revered by his former students, many of them, it's fair to say, wrote really eloquently about friendship. And he was somewhat frustrated, I think might be the good word to say, about Madison and a lot of the Enlightenment theories that sought to scientifically structure democratic mores, or at least root out negative impulses of human beings, as best they can by, you know, creating a balanced system, a Newtonian system, if you will, where checks and balances and an expansive government over vast territory that was, you know, compound in nature, et cetera, all of those things would serve as bulwarks against, you know, the less virtuous aspects found within human nature. But Madison also understood that there had to be a certain kind of affection for one's government, and that those affections could be cultivated. But he didn't really dig into how that would be. And I think this is where the ancients, as you suggest, had something to say about this. And I think in McWilliams's own work and the work of other writers, I reference Daniel S. Allen and her work on friendship, and Paul Gilroy, very significant contemporary African, or not African American, but Black Brit, had to say, I don't know what the correct parlance is, Afro-Brit, I don't know. But Paul Gilroy's work on the politics of conviviality speak to the ways in which you don't really have a multiracial democratic society without affections that work horizontally as well as vertically. Can't just be a connection and a set of affections to one's government. There had to be bonds between and amongst citizens. And I think that has always been the case. But I think, you know, many of your listeners will probably recognize that, in, as is the case in more recent times, when the bonds of democratic life begin to fray, certainly when our institutions begin to let us down, we have to go back to the blocking and tackling, if you will, of democratic life, and that is friendship. And if we don't have that, then we really lose the base of what connects us as human beings, the things that you know, create something higher than oneself. And friendship right after, you know, familial life, romantic life, friendship is right there that creates those bonds.
And so I wanted to ask you, you know, how you sort of started to pick up the other friendships, because you note you had this one that you sort of started out with regard to Du Bois. But how did you move to sort of go backwards to Jefferson, who is so problematic in so many ways, and also then forward, obviously, to Obama and Biden. And so you have also at the center of this thesis about interracial friendships that are in public. Because friendship is often something that we think about as a private relation that we do in private, because it's intimate, it's, you know, it's connected to two people or a couple of people, and it's not something that we necessarily sort of project as a public demonstration of a political engagement. So I would ask you, those are a number of questions embedded there. But I would first like to talk to you about, you know, this concept of friendship and conviviality.
Great. Well, you know, to begin with, I started in my mind with that wonderful story, probably told best by Edmund Morris and Theodore Rex, about the failed friendship, political relationship between Teddy Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington. I think we all have heard bits and pieces about the infamous dinner that he had at the White House that really threatened Teddy Roosevelt's standing, certainly within Southern circles, and really dismayed him because Washington's presence at that White House dinner caused such a disruption, particularly in the South, where all kinds of racist attitudes came out, not only against Washington, but frankly, more so against Roosevelt for hosting this social engagement with a Black man and with his wife present. But I mentioned that that story in passing because it was a failure. I go back to first Abraham Lincoln and his more successful three meetings with Frederick Douglass in the White House. And naturally, you begin to ask yourself the question, what was really the first instance in which a dynamic public figure of consequence in the United States engaged across racial lines with someone that had meaning for the Republic. And you really have to go back to the kind of failed relationship and connection between Benjamin Banneker, a free black man within Maryland, and then Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, whom Banneker reaches out to by writing him a letter, asking him in so many words to revisit his proper view of human nature as extolled in the Declaration, all men are created equal, and why, therefore, Jefferson nevertheless supports the evil institution of slavery. Now, that failed relationship, one in which Jefferson doesn't quite forthrightly address Banneker's concerns, but nevertheless gives him a kind of a proverbial pat on the back and supports his scientific work and suggests that maybe in someday in the future, when things are better situated, the races could be on better standing with each other. But that really, to my mind, is the first instance of an exchange, a public exchange between a founding member of the Republic and someone of color that had democratic implications. It's because Jefferson cannot leave his views as expounded upon in Notes on Virginia, in which he holds blacks racially inferior. It's because he cannot leave those views that we don't get a kind of cross-racial, trans-racial friendship, or at the very least, social interaction of a public nature between the two men. Jefferson tries, when he sounds off at the end of the letter with that, you know, now famous concluding, language, your humble, obedient servant, Thomas Jefferson. He also refers to Banneker as one of his brethren. And it's those two lines, calling Banneker one of his brethren, as well as calling him Jefferson calling himself your humble, obedient servant, that causes political problems for Jefferson. Why? Because he's suggesting friendship, social connection between blacks and whites is possible. And that is a problem. And I think the reason why, to go back to the second part of your question, I think what was of significance to me in writing this book and doing the research was that you begin to see over and over again that, yes, private friendships among the races have always been possible in American life. It's not like we had to wait for Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass to become friends in the White House for blacks and whites to develop friendship in the Western Hemisphere. But what that episode did suggest was that public figures, renowned, powerful whites, frankly, and in particular white men, who demonstrated public support for the idea of social equality, might have the ability to carry the day in terms of where the country was headed democratically. That yes, if blacks and whites were social equals, then ipso facto they could become political equals. And that was always part of the challenge in American life. And I think that's why I was drawn to the idea of friendship as not just a private kind of commodity, but something that had public consequences and meaning in a multiracial democracy.
And in terms of the multiracial democracy that we have with all of its problems around that particular issue, we do have sort of notions of friendship. And I would love for you to sort of explain just a little bit more, I guess, fully what it is that we're really talking about. You talk about the public nature of the engagement between Banneker and Jefferson. And, you know, one of the things that I've always been fascinated by in this discussion of friendship is not necessarily interracial, but across gender, that, you know, relationships between men and women that are friendships that are not in any way romantic seems to also be somewhat novel these days.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that could almost be another book. And maybe there's someone listening out there right now who would be willing to take up that sword. I think, you're 100% on the mark. Look, when Ralph Ellison, the famed black novelist, mid-20th century America, author of Invisible Man, when he speaks with Shirley Jackson through correspondence, he writes to her through her husband, Stanley Hyman, the famed literary critic. Ellison can't really correspond with another man's wife. And that says something about mid-20th century and perhaps even early 21st century values with respect to gendered relations and institutions like marriage and all they're purported to mean and what the boundaries are. I think that's an important moment there. Ellison and Hyman have an intellectual as well as personal relationship bound by real admiration and friendship. But, you know, they have to kind of play their roles. Shirley has to be the dutiful wife to Stanley and Ralph has to be the respectful friend. And so that's important, I think, as well, to be sure. We see this play out throughout American history and in these connections, undoubtedly. Frankly, it's not until really the 20th century where women begin to become significant public figures in their own right with respect to politics that these conundrums are addressed and or at the very least arise in a significant way. And I think it's valuable to point out to you know what the parameters are, and I think that's what we're talking about here. For me, when you look at these, you know, the variety of these relationships and how class and race and gender all factor into them, certainly race is, you know, in my estimation, most significant, primarily because of the its rootedness in the founding of this country. But the other elements are important. But what is clear, becomes clear, is that these friendships are indicators of, you know, trouble or maybe improvements in the democracy. It's almost as if the you know, the warning light is coming on in your car on the dashboard, you know, needs an oil change or whatever the case may be. You can see that when it begins to work, as in the case of Lincoln and Douglas, you know, there's a more hopeful kind of set of possibilities when you see when it doesn't quite work. In an episode that I don't really get into, but I reference, nevertheless, something like the relationship between Woodrow Wilson and W.E.B. Du Bois. You see how these fits and starts become emblematic of the period of time when multiracial friendship on a public level, among, you know, individuals of consequence, you know, begin to take hold or root, then it's a sign that the democracy is rebounding, or at the very least, making headway. And when the periods are closed and that's not really quite possible, you see the republic floundering. And so that's how I see it. And certainly the gendered aspect is part of that story because it, you know, it points back to us who we are in so many words.
And this connection between the Republic's strength and its floundering, and sort of the capacity for public figures to have or develop friendships across racial lines is one of the key features of your thesis. And I think it's really important and really hard to sort of connect and get at. Can you sort of give us the frame for that connection? Because I think it's so important and you draw it out, but it's not something that most people would necessarily say, yeah, oh, that's obvious.
Right. Well, you know, look, you know, I'm a political scientist, and as you know, and many of us have come across a very important article on racial orders by Roger Smith and Desmond King years ago now that talks about certain periods in American political history that were defining, rooted in a certain kind of racial, you know, set of consequences and relationships. And I think I used the idea of racial orders to periodize, if you will, these moments in American life where interracial friendship, fraternity were closed among public figures. And that's really from the Jeffersonian period, the founding period, until roughly the late 19th century, where we begin to see a kind of indeterminate period emerging. And then by mid 20th century, where we begin to see an opening of interracial friendship and its possibilities. And so thinking as I do about history and institutions and periods and why certain periods in American history matter, I sought to take that concept of American political development and apply friendship into, or mix friendship into, that milieu of thought. And that was what came out to me, these periods where, you know, in so many words, the door was shut. Maybe Benjamin Banneker could have white friends in Maryland as a private citizen, and he certainly did. Most of his friends were white, but he could not make friends with Thomas Jefferson. Absolutely not. By the time we get to someone like a Dr. Martin Luther King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel in the mid 20th century, we begin to see that door opening. And of course, they could be friends in private, but now they could also be friends in public, as could, you know, someone like a Jimmy Carter and an Andy Young, and ultimately a Barack Obama and a Joe Biden. And suffice it to say, just as is the case in, you know, thinking about racial orders or other kinds of moments of political time, if I could borrow that concept from Stephen Skowronek, we see that these are not necessarily rigidly set parameters, but rather fluid ones with occasional exceptions and morphings. But by and large, I think the framework holds, where there's this closed period and more indeterminate moment, probably best exemplified by Booker T. Washington and Teddy Roosevelt's friendship, and then a period that's clearly open, or at least opening. And I think we could trace that back to the mid-20th century, and frankly, the dawn of the Civil Rights Movement.
And so you have a collection of sort of quasi-friendships, as well as more substantive friendships, public and private ones. And I would love for you to sort of talk about how you collected these particular groupings. And you do have, you know, you have two, three groups that are women-to-women friendships, and most of the rest of them are men-to-men friendships, with the oddity of Ralph Ellison, Shirley Jackson, and her husband. And so what were you able to sort of see and glean from these particular relationships that was it really important that helped guide your thinking on this?
Well, I think for me, the key element was that the relationship had to have some political objective attached to it. You know, I can't tell you how many people over the course of my writing the book, you know, approached me with any number of suggestions about who might be included. And well, you know, that's a good one, I'd say, but, you know, I don't really see a democratic project attached to that. You know, a good one might be, you know, Andy Warhol and Basquiat, or Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson, you know. But, you know, maybe they were short-lived or not quite, you know, fully embracing of, you know, the political consequences of meaning at the moment. And frankly, there were other episodes that I knew better than others. So you have to play to your strengths. And as an author, you've got to know your strengths and weaknesses in terms of what your area of coverage is. But I think the Democratic Project was something that was really close to mind, top of mind for me, as I thought about these various cases. Certainly, I wanted an assemblage of cases that would speak to the breadth of the American experience and of the experience of identity. And I also included Marlon Brando and James Baldwin, yes, an interracial friendship among men, but also men who were either bisexual and or gay. And I think that was an important element to speak to, as well as the relationships between Black and white women. Critical to understanding how that dynamic has played out politically in American life, as well as privately, and the relationship between Black men and white men. And so I think having as much of a mix as I could of these different elements or characteristics of friendship were certainly important to round out what I thought would make up the most realistic telling of the story historically. And of course, again, some of this is dictated by just history, because we don't have a lot of 19th century cases involving women as significant public figures, right? You really have to wait until the mid-20th century, or at least the 40s. And so people like Mary McLeod Bethune, as a Black woman, begins to, figure into things, at least for me, as an example of FDR's Black cabinet, her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt is pretty profound on a private level, but also on a political and public level.
And of all the friendships that you analyzed, which one did you find to some degree the most interesting, not necessarily complex, but the most interesting to sort of put in this analysis and framework and think about in context?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm struck by Baldwin and Brando's relationship, because they're cultural figures and there's a certain kind of artistry to their lives that magnifies, I think, the beauty of the relationship. I think it was pretty intimate. And as many suggest, and as I allude to, is probably sexual as well. But I think, the intimacy there was so profound among those two men that one couldn't help be struck by the beauty of it, but also the pain involved. You know, I found that wonderful letter. I'd never heard of it before, seen of it before, read of it anywhere, doing research at the New School, where both Brando officially attended and Baldwin was kind of sneaking in, sneaking into acting classes without paying. Shout out to Baldwin for doing that hard work. But I was struck by the letter that I opened the chapter with Baldwin, pleading with Brando, really in a very strategic way, to take on a role that he has written for him, a screenplay, based on Baldwin's novel, Giovanni's Room. I was struck by how Baldwin said, "Hey, we've had a falling out. I'd like to see if it would be possible for us to be friends again, Marlon." And he doesn't really get into what has happened, and I don't know if we'll ever know. And I kind of like that. I like the way in which there are certain elements of these relationships that are so deep and profound that we don't get to know it all. We just get to know that it mattered to them. I'm struck by the beauty of it. And I dare say that part of the Madisonian failure, if you will, is that so much of the beauty attached, and I think McWilliams really honed in on this as a scholar and as an intellectual, so much of the beauty of Madison's system is attached to the system and institutions and processes, rather than people and ideas and hearts and minds. And I think these relationships, in particular that one, remind us that there's a kind of love that's a subtext to democratic life that has to be there. And we recognize it when we see the hate. We recognize it when we see the absence of love. We recognize it when we see the visceral, brutal faces at a place like Charlottesville over a few years ago. But we can also see it when there's love and admiration and profound respect and dignity shared between friends. And that relationship just, always makes me smile, gives me hope.
And I wanted to ask you about also two other artists that you sort of pay a lot of attention to here, in Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe, which is not oftentimes what we hear discussed with regard to either of these, artistic and brilliant women, is the relationship between the two of them. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of got to this friendship and what you see in it?
Well, you know, it was really funny because, you know, you couldn't help but do this research. And if you're typing anything about interracial friendship, you know, periodically on the internet, you'd get bombarded by these photos and articles, blogs about Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe. And frankly, many of these links, as I allude to in the chapter, point to how Marilyn Monroe saved Ella Fitzgerald's career by standing up for her and threatening not to show up at the Hollywood Club Macambo back in the 1950s. And, you know, you start to dig into these articles and what emerged to me was something significant. And it's about the stories we tell about friendship and believe about them that reflect something not only about the friendship themselves, but in this case, and perhaps many others, about what we want to be true, not necessarily what is true. That relationship was wonderful to write about, in part because Monroe does help Fitzgerald get into the Macambo, but not for the reasons that so many people on the internet believe. Fitzgerald had not been blacklisted, if you will, from attending or performing at the Macambo because of her race. We had people like Eartha Kitt and others perform there. It was because she was not perceived as overly sensual or sexy. She did not fit the bill of, the kind of siren that would be desired by Charlie Morrison and others who owned the Macambo and wanted, you know, lots of attendees, you know, hooting and hollering at women as they performed. And Monroe used her, her prestige, her own sexuality and persona to say in so many words, hey, if Ella's not good enough for you, neither am I. So it was less about race and some more about the sexualization of women and how Black women could, in certain instances, cross the line of segregation into the white world, provided that they were able to titillate white men. And I thought that was an interesting story in and of itself. So Marilyn Monroe was indeed heroic, but I think maybe we're not so heroic in our analysis because we so wanted to believe a kind of narrative about interracial friendship and missed, I think, an equally important one, which is Monroe as a benefactor, if you will, of Fitzgerald, but one who was attuned to how she was being shortchanged because of her appearance and her perceived lack of beauty. Really important story, and one that I think mattered in part because we still live with it. There it is on the internet, photos of the two of them and hundreds of stories. There's a play, God knows there was a play about it in London, Ella and Marilyn, and you know, all of this, and yet a fundamental aspect of it was wrong, and but important nevertheless for different reasons.
And I wanted to ask you next about the relationship across not just race, but also across faith or faith traditions. This, you know, the relationship between Martin Luther King and Rabbi Joshua Heschel is a more well-known story because there are so many pictures of the two of them together marching. But this is also the story of Blacks and Jews. And sort of two groups that are often othered in many societies and their connection to one another in terms of the civil rights movement. How did this particular example really reflect on what you're talking about with regard to the opening up of opportunities for modeling interracial relationships?
Well, look, we know that all faith traditions are steeped on one level in either a kind of prophetic tradition, if I could put on my Cornel West hat here for a minute, or they're steeped in a kind of legalistic, orthodox tradition that's structured and rooted in, you know, theology, a certain kind of theology. What strikes me, I think, about Heschel's relationship with King is that both men were attuned to a prophetic tradition. They both saw their respective faiths as tied to something deeper, helping marginalized people be recognized. Look, as I point out in the chapter, and as Susanna Heschel, Abraham Heschel's daughter, pointed out to me when I interviewed her, there were segregated Jewish stores in the South and in Selma that, one's particular, just as there were Christian stores, right, that were segregated. What made Heschel's connection to King so profound was Jewishness was not just an identity marker for Heschel. It was a faith he believed he needed to live out prophetically, to attach himself to the Old Testament tradition of breaking chains with Pharaoh, of, racism is evil, he says in Chicago, where King and he meet for the first time at a religious conference. And of course, we know for King, take the example of Vietnam. Many Christian churches, black and white, oppose his opposition to the war in Vietnam for many reasons. But King actually believes he needs to live out his faith, that he's not going to, contour or tailor his Christianity to what's politically popular. As he tells Clarence Jones, who was so gracious in speaking with me, he was the author of the I Have a Dream speech and the initial author of what became the speech at Riverside Church, the one that King rejects. King says to Clarence Jones, "Clarence, you know I can't say this. You know I have actual real beliefs about the Vietnam War. You need to bring me a speech that's critical of Vietnam." And Clarence Jones says, "Hey, man, I'm trying to protect you. I'm not just writing this speech for me, I'm writing it to protect you." King commissions another speechwriter after that, says, "I love you, Clarence, but I got to go elsewhere because I'm living out my faith. I actually am beyond, the politics of Christianity. I'm somewhere else." Just as Heschel was beyond the politics of what it meant to be a Jew in some very limited identifying way, it had to be active. And there's a beauty to their relationship too. And I interviewed Reverend Dick Fernandez, who lives in Philadelphia. He was very kind to me over the phone, gave me a lot of time. And he talked about how he would observe King and Heschel in meetings, and they would, kind of whisper with each other, and then they kind of just go off on their own, and you wouldn't see them for a long time. They just they liked each other. There was a real bond there. Personally, you got the sense that that too was private and had its own kind of delicious personal quality, that they just enjoyed each other's company and they joked with one another. As King says, "Heschel, were you on one of those slave ships in the Middle Passage?" Because he so understood the black experience, what it was to be in the inferno of blackness in America for so many centuries, frankly. How did you get that wisdom, Heschel? Well, Heschel got that wisdom because he took his faith seriously. He delved into something more than just Judaism as a kind of personal identifier. What does it mean to be a Jew prophetically? Profound experience. I loved doing that research, and I was so grateful that Susanna Heschel, who's a terrific scholar, and as many people know in her own right, clearly was just so helpful to me in pointing me to some of the papers and ideas that affected her father's work throughout his life.
And that particular chapter, you're also talking to people who were friends with these people, or children of, had close relationships to. So this concept of how the friendship worked, what its dynamics were, also comes through in your discussion there, which is really fascinating and sort of jumps off the page in a way that, you can get a lot of the information from letters to back and forth in archival research, but it's just a little bit different when you're able to talk about the friendships or the relationships directly.
I was so grateful for that, and a moment of disappointment. I really wanted to interview Gloria Steinem and Angela Davis. And for different reasons, who knows, I was told by one of Gloria Steinem's representatives that she understood the book was being written and was happy it was being written. I never heard from Angela Davis or any of her representatives. I did reach out, but I so would have loved to have spoken with both of them. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. And when it does work out, really all you have to do is just stay out of the way, because so many of these people have really stories they've been dying to tell and have just been waiting to be asked. And, you know, it was that way with Reverend Fernandez. It was that way, certainly, with Clarence Jones and others who just gave up their time graciously.
And so the one friendship that I, you know, personally have observed, as I think you have, is the one between former President Barack Obama and current President Joe Biden. And we saw it, you know, develop over the years. And obviously, we don't know what went on behind closed doors necessarily. But, you know, the point that you talk about, that that bestowal of the Medal of Honor with highest, whatever it was that Obama connected it to, and Biden sweeping, you know, I still think about it and it moves me. And that relationship, again, is one of across generations. There are two men from different times and different experiences, and not just their racial differences, but really different lived experiences. Can you talk a little bit about not only how you did the research for that chapter, but, you know, what it says with regard to our current racial dimensions in the United States, shall we say?
Sure. Well, you know, I could not interview Barack Obama or Joe Biden, but, you know, I will, for the paperback version, gentlemen, if you're listening, I'm happy if you're listening to this podcast, you know how to get a hold of me at Rutgers. You know, a lot of the, you know, the memoirs, Obama's memoir, Biden's biography, there are a number of biographies about both men out there, of course, and, you know, newspaper accounts of what was said and about the two. But I also wanted to situate their relationship in the context of the prior, let's say, 40 or 50 years of presidential politics, where we have moments like Bill Clinton and Vernon Jordan and their friendship, but a different kind of friendship. You know, Jordan is a fixer for Clinton. He's not forwarding a black agenda, if you will. Andy Young is with, Jimmy Carter. Then there's a real friendship there that opens the door. And I kind of wanted to get into some of these other cases, Condi Rice and George W. Bush, and try to express why Biden and Obama's friendship was so significant. I think it had to do first with the fact that we know it was genuine because initially they didn't like each other. And I think what's important about some of these stories is maybe all of them in a way are the disagreements that arise among friends or prospective friends. You know, I so often loathe the idea of friendship on the cheap, that somehow even the suggestion that maybe this book is an homage to the idea that we can just friend our way out of white supremacy, you know, or you know, the kind of cheap way we think about friends on social media. No, disagreement, maybe dislike even. I think Obama disliked Biden. That was pretty clear. But it wasn't an obstacle to getting to know him personally, certainly understanding his value politically. But when that line was crossed, as Danielle Allen says, once you talk to strangers and get to know them, all kinds of possibilities open up. As Gilroy said, once you begin to engage in the politics of conviviality, you see people as full human beings. And once you journey out into the stars and shadows, as Twain reminds us in Huck Finn, you know, democracy no longer has to be on the run. It can be maybe fugitive for a time, but maybe it can anchor and find a place and find a home. Well, Biden and Obama, to me, exemplify, you know, the hope that all of us can have, that perhaps we can develop a relationship that emerges out of disagreement, maybe even dislike, but then something deeper happens. And you begin to see both of these individuals reflecting on family. And that was what really, I think, hooked it in for Obama. It's clear that Biden's love for his family, his concept of family, so deep and broad and real, not fake. You know, as politicians often say, I mean, I want to take time to go with my family. No, Biden lived that. And of course, he's a man of sorrows, if I can employ that term. Biden, we know his history and the loss that he experienced as a young politician. These things meant something to Obama. And again, Biden's loyalty. You know, people ask, well, what's the, you know, why did black people vote for Biden in droves in the primaries? What was it that turned Biden around, you know, in South Carolina? We don't understand. It's because many of my progressive friends, let's be clear, were not pro-Biden people. Many on the left remain not pro-Biden people. What is it with black folks and Biden? Well, you know, for many years, black people have gone to work, sometimes in a position where they're the supervisor rather than being the ones being supervised. And they've seen how, on occasion, white subordinates have kneecapped them, have talked behind their back, have, you know, tried to take their place, as the OJs in their beautiful song Backstabbers have often written about or sung about over the years. You know, and here was Biden being loyal to Obama. Here was Biden, you know, never conveying any sense of disloyalty. And you know what? Black people looked at that, and I think still look at that, and have profound respect for that kind of person. That he never shortchanged Obama a whit, had his back, and I think Obama appreciated that. And that's a kind of turning point in American political history, where Obama can be free to be the one to be the giver of gifts, as, you know, Mary McLeod Bethune received FDR's walking cane after he passed away and Eleanor Roosevelt gave it to her. Or after Lincoln's assassination, Frederick Douglass gets something in the mail. He gets a package. Maybe it was sent FedEx. He gets a wonderful package. And what is it? It's Lincoln's walking cane, his walking stick, sent by Mary Todd Lincoln. These gifts are touchstones of the profundity of the relationship. And here we have a moment in American history where a black man, the president of the United States, can give a gift of his own. He's not the recipient of a cane. He's the giver of a different kind of gift. And it marks a turning point. And yes, it's always vulnerable. And as we saw with Trump, soon cheapened and soon watered down beyond all recognition, but it doesn't mean it can't be restored. And I hope that as readers think about their own individual relationships, ultimately, that's going to be what I hope, you know, becomes a kind of legacy of the book, whomever it reaches, that we reflect on our own relationships and try to do better by ourselves and those we call our friends.
And so with that coda, what are you working on now, Saladin?
Well, I'm speaking of Abraham Lincoln. I've just written the first pages of an introduction that I hope will become a good book about Abraham Lincoln's early political thought, centered around his Lyceum address, but really about the 1830s in America and what Lincoln saw that terrified him about that period of time, despite the fact that so many people historically have viewed the 1830s as a period of great democratic expansion. And to an extent, that's true. But Lincoln saw some things happening in the country that gave him great concern. And I want to dig into what kind of created a prophetic sorrow in Lincoln in that Lyceum address and in his early political thought that was of consequence for him going forward. So that's what I'm working on now, a little bit of early Abraham Lincoln political thought that I hope will sometime in the future become a book.
Well, I look forward to reading it and talking to you about it. The Lyceum address is definitely one of my favorites.
And I'm glad to hear that.
It is profound and eloquent and important, I think. But I'll let you talk about it in your book and talk to you about that then. I'd like to thank Saladin Anbar for joining me today to talk about Stars and Shadows, The Politics of Interracial Friendship from Jefferson to Obama, available, I assume, at Oxford University Press website, published in 2022, and at independent booksellers, wherever you find them. Is there a brick and mortar store in New Jersey that you want to give a shout out to?
Sure. Labyrinth Books in Princeton is a great place. Head House Books in Philadelphia is a wonderful place. There are lots of great independent bookstores, and I would encourage readers to ask them for the book. And hopefully I'll be talking at Labyrinth in the fall. That would be nice. But whether I do or not, it's a great local bookstore. But there are so many, and Head House has been a kind place for writers over the years over there in Old City in Philadelphia. So wherever you live, check it out. Yep.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lily. Always great to see you.